Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In the 1840s, the First African Baptist Church in Richmond, Virginia, were faced with a very difficult decision. They had heard appeals to aid the Irish people who were starving in their thousands during the Great Hunger. However, the church congregants had their own equally pressing needs. They could, for example, spend their very limited resources buying freedom for the enslaved members of the church. Remarkably, they would choose to send money to Ireland. Stories like this one are one of the few uplifting dimensions to the tragedy that was the Great Hunger. However, we rarely consider why people decided to help the starving Irish at the time. We often forget that each donation, large or small, involved a decision to give money to Ireland at the expense of something or someone else. Suffering, after all, was by no means unique to Ireland at the time. In this podcast, based around one of the most thought-provoking interviews I've done this year, Annalisa Schrout shares stories of remarkable generosity from the 1840s. But she also picks apart the reasons why people, often with very meagre resources, gave so generously. We also delve into some of the more controversial donations, particularly that of the Charleston Hibernian Society, many of whose members were enslavers. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer. Now, as mentioned in the introduction, today's show is a fascinating interview that'll reshape how you understand aid given to the starving Irish during the Great Hunger. While it chronicles remarkable stories of generosity, Annalisa Schrout asks the more complicated question, why did these people give so generously? What did they hope to achieve aside from alleviating suffering in Ireland? Now, her research on this subject is actually the basis of her new book, Aiding Ireland. I've links to this and Annalisa's socials in the show notes below. If you enjoyed the episode, which I'm pretty sure you will, check those out. The book is a really easy read, but explores aspects of the Great Hunger we don't often think about. And lastly, before we dive into the episode, just a heads up to supporters of the show on Patreon and Acast Plus. Your exclusive series on how the Troubles began continues this week. In what will be episode 2, we'll be looking at the IRA border campaign of the late 1950s and the emergence of the civil rights campaign in the 1960s. These are key to understanding the outbreak of the Troubles, as the 1960s would prove to be a time of rising tension, but also hope and expectations, which were ultimately dashed. Now, you'll have that episode on Patreon or Acast Plus on Thursday. If you're not a supporter of the show, you can still get that episode by signing up today at patreon.com/Irish Podcast or Acast Plus. You'll get this episode, which is released on Thursday, as well as the first episode and the entire back catalogue of exclusive content as well. That address, one more time, is patreon.com/Irish Podcast. I've links to that in the show notes as well. Sound on this episode is by Kate Dunley. Now, to begin our conversation, Annalisa began by setting out the context of the 1840s and what happened in Ireland. Pretty remarkably, she does this in just 90 seconds. It's incredibly succinct.
The potato blight appeared in Europe in 1845. It actually came from North America. We now know that it was caused by fungus, but at the time, farmers would go to bed with perfectly sound fields of potatoes and wake up and find that they had just putrefied overnight. So there are these incredible descriptions of just like black, rotten morasses where previously perfectly sound crops had been. So this fungus impacted potato crops across North America, across Europe, but it particularly impacted Ireland, as I suspect many of your listeners will know, because rural Irish people depended almost exclusively on the potato for food. And that is in large part because of a long-standing system of tenancy and colonialism, whereby most of the residents of rural Ireland were tenants living on increasingly small plots of land, so that had plots of land that had shrunk over generations. And the thing about potatoes is that in terms of the calories you need to feed a person or a family, potatoes take up relatively little space. So if you're trying to feed a family on wheat, you need much more space than if you're feeding a family on potatoes. So in many ways, they were a crop that made sense. But the problem with monoculture is that if a disease impacts that crop, then you find that you have no food supply at all. Between 1845 and 1855, when most historians sort of think about the crisis, the immediate impact of the crisis ending, out of a population of approximately 8.5 million in 1845, about a million people had died and more than 2 million people had left.
While the Great Hunger devastated Ireland, it was also the first truly international humanitarian crisis. It differed from anything that had gone before it. Annalisa now explains how it happened to coincide with a revolution in printing, which allowed people across the world to read about the Great Hunger and relate to it in ways that would have previously been impossible.
At the early part of the 19th century, news was still a fairly elite product. So newspapers cost a fair amount of money. Many people couldn't read. And so the notion that information would circulate through print was actually limited to particular spheres of people. But by the 1830s, there was this revolution in printing technology that meant that there was the rise of things called penny papers, so newspapers that cost a penny, sometimes even less. And that meant that news was able to access wider ranges of people than ever before. Along with this, there were increases in literacy. And even if you couldn't read, this new print culture sort of created salons and coffee shops where people could go in and have the newspapers read to them. So information was able to circulate farther and wider. And it was also able to circulate faster because of changes in transportation technology. So in the late 18th century, it could take more than a week for news to travel from, say, the west coast of Ireland to Dublin, because the fastest that news could move was at the speed of a horse. But by the start of the famine, improved roads and railroads meant that news from the West Coast, from some of the worst impacted areas, was able to cross the island relatively quickly, and then was able to be borne out of Ireland relatively quickly. The advent of steamships meant that information could reach American audiences in only a few weeks. It could reach British audiences in a matter of days. So what all of this meant was that while this incredible crisis was happening, people around the world could hear about it and react to it in a timescale that they felt like they could actually do something. So it wasn't reading about a crisis that happened months ago where maybe my donation won't make an impact, but it was people really had the sense that when they were giving money, they could actually make a material change to the lives of people that they were reading about. One thing that I thought was really interesting when I started this process is I was thinking that the famine would sort of fit into this trajectory of philanthropy. But actually what I found is that this is one of the first moments when people become really interested in giving to people far away. So there wasn't a longstanding history of giving to distant sufferers. The famine really helped people to imagine that international philanthropy was possible, which is why I think it's worth sort of thinking about the famine in this context, as well as in a context of the Irish diaspora and other kind of demographic impacts.
The response to the plight of the Irish was incredible, and the scale of aid sent to Ireland was immense. This was funneled through two large organizations, but also lots of smaller ones too. Annalisa explains the background of these organizations and a sense of the overall monies raised.
So I think for me, one of the really interesting things about famine fundraising is that it came, as you say, from so many different sources. So some of them were what we might call mainstream relief organizations. And there were two really big ones, the British Relief Association, which was founded by Londoners working largely in finance, and then the Society of Friends founded a group called the Central Relief Committee. And so those were the two major sort of recipients of donations from around the world. And the groups that would send money to these two big organizations would often be sort of small ad hoc committees that would spin up in towns and villages only to raise money for Ireland and then sort of dissolved. But if we think about those two main groups just to begin with, the British Relief Association raised £200,000, which is equivalent to purchasing power today in something like £20 million. And the Society of Friends gathered even more. So they raised about £400,000, which is closer to £50 million today. And so those, in addition to those, these smaller organizations also raised considerable amounts of money. So one of the ones that I'm really interested in is the General Relief Committee of New York City, which raised funds from people all around New York State. And they raised $200,000, which is equivalent to about £5 million today. So to put that in contemporary context, it's February of 2024, and the UK government recently announced a $100 million aid package to Ethiopia. So the scale of famine relief in the 1840s was comparable to what governments are doing in terms of famine relief and mitigation today.
While the overall amount of money raised was vast, the actual sums of each individual donations was comparatively small. It was actually quite like crowdfunding today. However, what is significant is that these small donations were a lot for the people who were giving them. They often had very meager resources.
Most of the donations themselves were relatively small. So thousands upon thousands of people sent money to these relief organizations. And their donations were sometimes at the dollar, $10. Some people gave on the order of cents or shillings. And for these people, the donations actually represented a really significant part of their household income. A lot of people who were sending money to Ireland didn't have a lot to share to begin with. It meant that they were giving up food or some other thing that they wanted to buy. So even these very tiny amounts were often proportionally a really large share of household money. And I think that that is sort of as extraordinary as the total amount of money that was donated, that it was all of these people giving relatively small amounts in what seemed like a spontaneous effort to aid distant sufferers.
In terms of the stories we're going to look at in this episode, we first need to understand how Ireland was viewed internationally at the time, and why did the stories of the suffering Irish resonate with people? It's important to bear in mind that Ireland in the 1840s was beset with multiple problems at pretty much every level of society. But this allowed people across the world from very different and diverse backgrounds to relate to what was happening in Ireland. Annalisa began by explaining how some related to Ireland by viewing it through the prism of a colony exploited by Britain.
One of the reasons that I think the famine became this sort of humanitarian cause celebre was that Ireland in the 1840s was this sort of perfect encapsulation of failed governance. So people who work on famines often talk about how they are almost never actually an indication that there is not enough food, but rather that governments are not helping food to get to subjects in the right ways. So in Ireland, there were lots of different examples of people who were obligated to the Irish people failing to do that work of obligation. So, for example, commentators around the world noted that the relationship between Britain and Ireland in this period was basically non-functional. And it was non-functional because Ireland occupied this really uncomfortable place politically with respect to Britain. In some ways, it was highly colonial. A number of scholars have noted that in the 17th and 18th century, Ireland was basically the colonial laboratory for what became the British Empire in the 19th century. And in fact, the Royal Irish Constabulary was the model for policing all of these other parts of the empire. So policing in British colonies in the Caribbean was built on the Irish model. So in some ways, Ireland is kind of this like proto-colony.
While some viewed Ireland as a colony exploited by Britain, at the very same time, others saw the situation in very different terms. Ireland was, after all, part of the United Kingdom, and some saw it as an example of a country suffering from political overreach at the hands of a central government. This narrative would resonate particularly among enslavers in the American South.
Some Irish people elected some other Irish people to be MPs, and those MPs served in Westminster. Prior to 1801, there was an independent Irish parliament, but after the rebellion of 1798, that parliament was dissolved, and Irish political leadership was shifted to London. So in that way, Ireland was kind of part of this constitutional monarchy. And so what this meant is if you wanted an example of failed colonialism, you could look to Ireland for that. But if you wanted an example of the dangers of integrating recalcitrant subjects into a parliamentary system, you could also look to Ireland for the failures of that. In addition, this was a period in which some Irish politicians were arguing that Ireland really should be thought of as an independent nation. And so if you wanted an example of the dangers of rampant nationalism, so too could you look to Ireland. If you wanted an example of sort of even more granular failures of governance, you could look to the fundamentally failed relationship between landlords and tenants, because in this period, basically landlords had felt like they were not able to extract sufficient rents from their tenants, and tenants did not have enough money to pay their rents. And so everyone sort of felt like they were living on a knife's edge. And so for all of these reasons, sort of all of the pressing political needs of the 19th century, you could look to Ireland as a way that those needs had not been met. And I think because of that, it was really easy for people around the world to sort of take the famine and tell their own story about it that was relevant to their own local politics.
As we moved on to look at specific stories, Annalisa began with the most remarkable of all, that of the first African Baptist church in Richmond. Annalisa began by explaining what the church was and, more importantly, who its congregants were.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So this was one of, for me, the most compelling case studies in the book. And it was one that I didn't know about when I started working on this project. So the First African Baptist Church was a congregation in Richmond, Virginia. And in this period, in the 1840s, slavery was still legal in 15 states and territories in the United States. All of those were in the U.S. South. So when I talk about the South, I'm often using that as sort of a synonym for places where slavery was legal. The church was a Black church, but it had actually begun as a church, a Baptist church for both Black and white parishioners. But in 1841, white members of the congregation decided that they no longer wanted to worship with their Black neighbors, many of whom were actually enslaved by white members of the church. So the white congregation departed, sort of spun off into their own church. And in 1841, the First African Baptist Church was founded. What this meant was that the First African Baptist Church was a center of Black life in Richmond. And Richmond in this period is kind of interesting because some of the people who were enslaved there came with the people who enslaved them from more rural plantations. So when their enslavers came into the city, enslaved people would come with them. But Richmond was also a factory city. And so some enslavers who lived in more rural environs would rent out the people they enslaved to factory owners, which meant that there was this population of people who were enslaved, but who had a little bit more autonomy than they would have if they were living in the surveillance state of plantations. Additionally, there were a number of free people of color who lived in Richmond. And so the First African Baptist Church was this really heterogeneous population of people who were free, of people who were enslaved. One of its most famous members actually shipped himself to the North. He put himself in a box and had himself mailed north in order to escape slavery. So it was this really like vibrant social space, but also a space of really community support. So if you look through the church records, which are just this incredible resource, they list things like donations to poor sufferers in the congregation. They talk about helping out other members of the congregation. But not until 1847 is there any mention of sending money outside of the church. And so it's really extraordinary that in 1847, they decided that they were going to raise funds, as they just wrote in their minutes, for the suffering of Ireland.
The reasons why the church gave money are really interesting. These were very difficult decisions, as I mentioned at the top of the show. The church could have spent the money freeing its own members from slavery.
The church records didn't include any documentation of discussions that played out in the church. They're quite mechanistic, but it's possible to sort of reconstruct the information environment that this congregation was living in by looking at white newspapers that circulated in Richmond and also black newspapers that were printed in the north. But we have lots of evidence that both Southern white newspapers and black newspapers from the north were circulating amongst Richmond's black community. So we know that congregants in the First African Baptist Church were reading from all of these sources. And in the white newspapers, an overwhelming theme when talking about Ireland, and especially about fundraising for Ireland, was that people who sent money to Ireland were unimpeachably moral, deeply humane. This was evidence of their sort of success at being patricians and helping out the less fortunate. Black newspapers reported really extensively on the extent of Irish suffering, including reports from actually Frederick Douglass, who was a leading Black thinker and anti-slavery activist who toured Ireland in the 1840s. And so there was a lot of interest in what was happening in Ireland. But the reason that I think that the congregation of the First African Baptist Church gave was in part because they knew about this crisis. But as you say, their funds could have been used for many other causes too, right? This is a period when people could buy freedom through a process called manumission. And so choosing to send money to Ireland meant in many ways that they were choosing not to buy food and clothing, but also choosing not to put that money towards purchasing the freedom of themselves or their loved ones. So what I think this donation did was use white Richmonders' ideas that charity towards Ireland was uniquely humane and say, hey, you continue to dehumanize us, right? This is a period when many white commentators in the South talk about Black people in just incredibly dehumanizing terms. So it was sort of using the vernaculars of white charity to claim humanity in a time and a place when there were ongoing campaigns of dehumanization. And I think just the fact that they raised funds for Ireland and for nowhere else does tell us that this donation was doing some really important political and rhetorical work beyond the obvious and immediate work of helping sufferers. So Ireland provided something for these donors that other causes wouldn't. And I think that is mostly about the fact that giving to Ireland was understood to be this marker of humanity.
Now, while slaves gave money, so too did enslavers. This was done through something called the Charleston Hibernian Society. Annalisa explains who they were.
The Charleston Hibernian Society was this Irish fraternal organization. It was founded by Protestant merchants in 1801. And by the start of the famine, it had become this sort of social club for Charleston movers and shakers. So in some ways, it's not surprising that they raised money for their fellow countrymen, though most of the members of the Charleston Hibernian Society wouldn't have had connections to the people who were literally starving to death in rural Ireland. It was both different religious groups and also to different class. But when they talk about these donations, they use that language of sort of unimpeachable humanity that I talked about in Richmond. And they did this because in the 19th century, abolitionists in the United States, so people advocating for the wholesale abolition of slavery, had done a pretty good job of creating a rhetorical framework that cast enslavers as deeply inhumane, as cruel, as capricious, as basically people with low morals. And this upset enslavers who felt like, despite the fact that they held other humans in bondage, they felt like they were actually really good, upstanding people. And so they talk a lot about their donations as sort of counter evidence to these abolitionist campaigns that cast enslavers as inhumane. But they also use their donations to draw comparisons between the experiences of enslaved people in the United States and of people starving to death in Ireland, and to make this argument that, in fact, because enslaved people were given food as part of their enslavement, they were actually better off than starving Irish people. And in fact, in the lectures he gave in Ireland, Frederick Douglass warned about this interpretation. He was very clear that he was really worried about how Irish suffering might be mobilized to the detriment of enslaved people, whereas he thought we should be thinking much more about solidarity amongst people who were suffering under oppressive systems.
The most ludicrous claim the enslavers would make was that they faced similar hardships to the starving Irish, or even were more oppressed than them.
The last just completely kind of bizarre framework that enslavers used sort of after they, in the later years of the famine, so in 1848, after they had made this argument about their unimpeachable morality and about how enslaved people were actually better off, they actually pivot and say, it's not that there are parallels between Irish people and enslaved people, but actually there are parallels between Irish people starving to death and enslavers, which on the face of it is a wild claim because enslavers were not starving to death. They had ample food and ample money. A writer in 1848 said that slaveholding states were fast becoming Ireland of the North American continent, inhabited by a people generous, brave, and magnanimous, and yet bound down by heartless and ambitious traitors. So in this case, the heartless and ambitious traitors in with respect to the Irish are the British government, and the heartless and ambitious traitors with respect to enslavers are the U.S. government, which at the time, the U.S. politics was really caught up with this idea of whether slavery could expand to new territories. But the author went on to argue that enslavers were actually worse off than the Irish, because while Irish people could flee to the United States, enslavers weren't being allowed to expand into new territories. So you go from the Irish are like model subjects, recipients of aid, the Irish are worse off than enslaved people, to actually, we are most like the starving Irish.
Now, the fact that enslavers were willing to give money to Ireland at the time created problems back in Dublin. The Quakers, who were centrally involved in famine relief, were also deeply opposed to slavery. So some Irish people were, by extension, opposed to accepting donations from enslavers.
The way that I know that these claims had political traction is actually that people who were collecting these donations were really worried about what it meant to accept money from enslavers. So I talked before about the Society of Friends Central Relief Committee. The Society of Friends are Quakers, and they were at the forefront of abolitionist campaigns in the 19th century. And so in 1847, a Dublin Quaker named Richard Allen started to get really worried about what it would mean to accept money for Irish famine relief from enslavers as the Quakers were sort of conducting these abolitionist campaigns. And he said that if they accepted these donations, it would stamp the enslavers with the seal of Christian fellowship and justify their pretensions to genuine kindness and compassion. So basically, Richard Allen was worried that he and his fellow Quakers would be laundering the reputation of enslavers by accepting their money. And I think there's a lot of evidence that these enslavers were thinking about their donations as a kind of reputational laundering.
Now, the last story we talked about is one that is well known, and that is the aid sent by the Cherokee and Choctaw Nations. This is pretty famous in Ireland and indeed around the world, but it's never really asked why the Cherokee and Choctaw gave money to Ireland. To understand this better, we need to get a better sense of the experiences of the Cherokee and the Choctaw in the years prior to the Great Hunger. It was a devastating time in their history.
This whole book actually began because I wanted to explore the donation from the Cherokees and the Choctaws, because I think, like many people, I find it to be just a really compelling example. These are people who, a decade before the famine, had been forced off of their ancestral homelands in the American Southeast by the U.S. government because white settlers wanted that land. And the U.S. government, in enacting this quote-unquote Indian removal policy, made an argument that indigenous people were not sufficiently civilized to live in proximity to white settlers. Now, they needed to be brought up to a degree of civility before they could be integrated into white society. And so there were campaigns of what was called acculturation. There were missionaries who were sent to first these Indian nations in the Southeast and then to the area called Indian Territory, which is now the state of Oklahoma, with sort of this long-term mission of making indigenous people more white. So this is sort of the backdrop against which their donations took place. They had just been forcibly removed from their lands. They had very limited resources. Many people were sick. The Trail of Tears, which is the sort of descriptor of their journey from their ancestral lands out to Indian Territory, was a demographic crisis. I think there are estimates that at minimum one member of every family died. It was incredibly traumatic. And so a decade after that, still living through that trauma, Cherokees and Choctaws decided to raise money for Ireland. And so I think they did it because, sort of like the congregants of the First African Baptist Church, doing so allowed them to make some political arguments that really weren't accessible to them in other ways. And so the first one was simply very much like the First African Baptist Church, an argument that Cherokees and Choctaws didn't need to be quote unquote civilized, that they had in fact intrinsic indigenous morality that had a long history of gift giving. And so the way that the donations were talked about in the indigenous press was not as evidence that missionaries had done a good job inculcating Christian values amongst the Cherokees and Choctaws, but rather as evidence that Cherokees and Choctaws themselves already had this tradition of giving and were simply extending it to the Irish. And so I think one of the things that that did was undermine the US government's sort of foundational claim that Indian removal was justified because of the, I keep using the word incivility, and I hope everyone can hear the intense air quotes that I'm putting around it, but the quote unquote incivility of indigenous people.
They were also doing this to highlight similarities between the actions of the British government in Ireland and their own treatment at the hands of the US government.
But the other thing that these donations did was allowed Cherokee and Choctaw leaders to draw parallels between the behavior of the British government with respect to Ireland and the US government with respect to Indigenous nations. So in the United States in this period, it was pretty much universally understood that the problem with Ireland could be traced to British mismanagement, and particularly with sort of a rapacious imperialism that was coming home to roost in Ireland. And so Indigenous leaders were able to point to that and say, sort of just like the Irish have this terrible experience with respect to the British, so too are we having a terrible experience. This is a period before, like, the language of anti-colonialism that we're used to today was really prevalent. So we wouldn't expect anyone to be using that language. But in comparing their experiences to those of the Irish, it's sort of a nascent critique of colonialism in a period where no Indigenous leaders could come out forcibly in opposition to the US government, just because they were basically occupied by federal soldiers and by officials. They were trying to actually fight removal in the US courts. So outright resistance wasn't really available, but drawing parallels between Irish and Indigenous experiences was one way of sort of leveling that critique in a sub rosa way.
I want to thank Annalisa for taking the time to chat with me. It was a really interesting discussion. You can get her book, Aiding Ireland, at the link in the show notes below. Finally, don't forget that the second part of my supporter series on the Troubles drops on Thursday. That's Thursday, February the 22nd. If you're not already a supporter, you can find links in the show notes below to Patreon and Acast Plus. Until next time, Sloan.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.